Guys, we are live again for another amazing episode of Deep Dive. And guys, we have made it through the series talking about the 70s Joshi wrestling history, the peak era as far as attendance records and amazing things being done in All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling in the 80s. And now we are in another important pivotal time in Joshi wrestling, which was the 90s. And there are a lot of ups, a lot of downs, a lot of ebbs and flows that have really shaped that era for Joshi wrestling. But I am really excited to dive into that. So let's just get into it, shall we?
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Women's Wrestling Talk, the number one women's wrestling show on the planet.
Hello, guys. It is Candace, the Ladies Wrestling Grill, and I am excited to come back for another episode of Deep Dive. As we know, this is a very exciting time in wrestling this week as we are deep into Mania Week. And with that, even outside of conversations about WWE, this week just lends itself to people just gearing up to talk about wrestling, many times going back in time to look at some moments that really piqued their interest in wrestling in general. So I am really happy to add another bit of flavor to this week with culminating this series that I started off in March, talking about the history of Joshi wrestling. And we have gone now, we have reached a point, I think, in this conversation that a lot of people like myself love talking about, because there's just a wealth of footage and memories and everything surrounding this time and Joshi wrestling, and that is certainly the 90s. I think without wanting to rush, the different parts of Joshi wrestling, the history of it, I can't lie, I was absolutely ecstatic to talk about this time in the history of Joshi wrestling, because it's one that I think shaped, I think it's safe to say, about 20 years of wrestling after that, that we're still talking about today, that we can cite and look at a lot of things that were taken from that time period. There are many things that were awesome that happened in that time. A lot of things that literally are from the 90s and is probably going to stay there. But even then, just some great memories to talk about. So let's dive into it, because there is a ton of things that happened in 90s Joshi wrestling. So kind of wrapping and bringing everything together, when we've come to this series with Joshi wrestling, we've seen that since the mid-70s, All Japan Pro Wrestling, Women's Pro Wrestling, have really lit the fire of what Joshi wrestling could be. They hit heights that honestly, I still don't feel that women's wrestling in the U.S. has hit, especially during that peak time in the 80s with attendance records, opportunities even outside of wrestling that these women in Japan were able to hit. But when many stars, top stars in their company, hit their mid-20s, they were forced to retire, as were the rules of that time. But these women still knew that they had a lot more to offer the business. And almost every past main eventer in All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling started a promotion going into that late 80s and certainly early to late 90s. You had women like Chikuza Nagayo, Aja Kong, Kyoko Inoue, Jaguar Yokota, and Mayumi taking a stab at being a promoter, or at least founding a promotion during this time. It was so much coming out at that time that it could really make your head spin trying to keep up with the different promotions that was sparked out of this time. So in the start of the 90s, All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling started to feel that they had acquired a few rivals from these newer women promotions popping out. You had places like LLPW, JWP, and FMW being some of the bigger competitors coming out of this early phase of the 90s. And that affected attendance records due to fans choosing to see one promotion with a niche gimmick or focus that they liked, and they wanted to see that instead of going to more of the huge or having the huge diverse crowds that All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling was used to in the 70s and 80s. Live crowds in the 80s were on a really good day and the 15,000 plus mark. And in some shows in the 90s, you had it going down even to 1,000 plus if some promotions were lucky. However, the funny part about that is even when some attendance records kind of went down, you still saw a high of people really showing that they loved the in-ring action that I feel was at its supreme best during the 90s. And I certainly think a lot of people do, as they cite 90s Joshi wrestling at being at its highest level before those, after those two decades, when Joshi wrestling was still kind of getting its footing. In the 90s, completely different story with the in-ring work that we saw at that time. So you had this weird thing that actually, looking back when I was doing research, this was something that was kind of happening all over the world with 90s wrestling, is that everyone just started having these splinter companies and trying to compete with some of the companies that had monopolies in the 80s. And you had a generation in the 90s that was kind of moving away from a lot of things that were quite common in the 80s. That was a bit poppy, you know? So it started to create more of a rebel-based, extremely graphic type of environment. Whether it was in America, we saw a lot of promotions like ECW pop up. You started to see that a bit more in, obviously, even that went into Joshi wrestling. So everyone had their thing. If some people still liked what they saw in the 80s, then they found a promotion that would cater to that. So as we're talking about these other promotions, we have to talk about in detail what key promotions popped up during this time. And we can kind of start off with JWP, because the reason why I wanted to cite JWP first, because they were the first to really try to take it to All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling. And even if it's not, or was it in a vindictive way, they made it clear there should be other options. We should be able to showcase wrestling in the way that we see it. And even when I was looking into it, JWP was one of the few, one of the first or few to be able to really have in the 90s, in that decade, to really have it where they were seen kind of toe-to-toe with All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling, which I thought was pretty impressive considering that they had only started in 1986. You see this overwhelming success that All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling is having and the stranglehold that they had on the wrestling world for two decades almost. So I thought it was very clever for Jackie Soto to found and operate JWP. And she was one half of the popular tag team in the 70s, Beauty Pair. And she started to acquire wrestlers that had retired from All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling due to that 26 retirement age. And Devil Masami was one that had to retire in the late 80s. And she definitely wanted to be a part of JWP. And that was a big draw considering how successful Devil Masami's career was at that time. They also acquired World Judo medalist Shinobu Kendori. And these were big draws and really helped early on to build credibility for JWP. They really also made sure that not only were they trying to establish people that had experience and could really help the younger talent, but really get some strong newcomers that had promise. And they did that with Dynamite Kanzi, Mayumi Osaki, and Cutie Suzuki, among others. they really had a solid roster. And I loved seeing that when I was looking back at this time, is that JWP seemed like, especially in the beginning, that they had a strong plan on how they were going to be able to draw people to their product. They made sure that they hit those two tiers, have enough talent that really knew the ins and outs on how to be a star in the company and to be a main roster attraction, but then also really keep your eye on the talent that need an opportunity, especially from that influx of people, that women who really wanted to become wrestlers after the 80s influence of Joshi wrestling. So I think that they were able to do both. And at one point, especially I think as the 90s started to roll in, JWP was seen as number two to All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling. But due to infighting and disagreements on the direction of the company, JWP officially closed down their doors, but then they had a second incarnation, something that you will see a lot or hear a lot in this particular episode, is that sometimes you'll see this infighting, disagreements, someone might leave who actually helped to found the company, but then somehow they'll come back together and like slightly change the name of the company, but it's still relatively the same thing. You will see that a lot. So just get used to hearing that. So you see this second incarnation, and that's when you see Rumi Kasami, who was also a part of developing JWP, split off into a splinter company called Ladies Legend Pro Wrestling. And they were able to, even with all this infighting and disagreements, they were able to secure a TV spot in 1993, a video game in 1994, and much more. So even with all of these things that would pop up that obviously would cause tension, they were still able to thrive as we were really getting into that sweet spot of 90s Joshi wrestling, which truly was 92, 93, 94. So that was awesome to me that they were still able to move forward and not let certain things cause JWP to have to permanently close doors. It just seemed like maybe in 92, there was just a bit of reevaluating and reconstructing of the company. And JWP was mature enough to make sure that they were doing some interpromotional events with companies like All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling to show that they could really draw together and make sure that they were getting those great attendance records. Because at the end of the day, when you have talent, you want to make sure that they can be exposed to as many people as possible. So I love that even if the initial reason was to show All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling that they could be competition, they understood and really caught on to the fact that a large amount of crowds would come to see these super shows with these companies. And it really did work. Now, in 2000, JWP did close again, but a few months later, they had a resurgence. But it really, at that point, was just a shell of its former self and never really got back to the glory days of the late 80s, early 90s. But I still think that with the ups and downs of the company, they truly were the most successful, in my opinion, to show what another company could do in the 90s and serve itself as an alternative, I guess you could say, with All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling. So now we move on to another impressive company that started out in the 90s as well. And they were a result of that splinter that you saw early on with the interfighting and disagreements that actually came out to create a really good company, in my opinion, and that's LLPW. I think there were some great wrestlers and feuds that came out of this company. So you see Rumi Kazami and Shinobu Kandori split from JWP. And you would think that obviously that would probably lend itself to them not having an opportunity to create a successful promotion, but they were able to. And that was short for Ladies Legends Pro Wrestling, LLPW. And they were more of a mat-based wrestling promotion, but they also offer a lot of other variety. But I like how they kind of found something that kind of separates them from the other companies that were just popping up out of the woodworks, and really made sure that they put themselves in their own bubble while still being impressive and being able to compete competitively with other companies and not feel like they didn't have something to bring to the table. And in this promotion, Shinobu Kendori was the ace of the company. And I think that that was a smart move, because you will see that with other promotions, where sometimes you'll have like a booker that's constantly putting themselves as the main event. But I think because Kendori just pretty much started her career in the 90s, and was certainly impressive, it didn't look like it was just like nepotism thing or having an ego. She actually really fit with that type of marketing that they wanted for LLPW. So it made sense that she would be one of the top draws for the company and be a main event talent. So we had Noruri Tatino from the Jumping Bomb Angels, Igu Sawi, Harley Sato, and Rumi Kazawa make up a portion of that early roster of LLPW. And Kendori had an amazing feud. Just to highlight one of the things that that really stuck out to me when I was looking up LLPW with AJW's Akira Hokuto, and that was in the 1993-94 era of LLPW in All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling. And even though they did not have the same exposure that All Women's All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling had, or JWP, because they did not have TV time, they were still able to lock in a really great attendance record for people coming into these shows, and also be able to be a part of those inter-promotional shows and really get a strong following for the wrestlers that were a part of the company. So I think that's a huge success story, to not have TV time. And it wasn't like this was, you know, 2010s or even now, where you might be able to survive with not having TV time by being on YouTube or any other like form of streaming. For them to still be able to get the crowds that they did and to have a successful company all the way up into 2002. And even then, they started doing a few more or getting back into promoting the 2010s. That's still really impressive, especially when at one point, the waters did become a bit muddied with how many Joshi promotions were starting at this time. I think that was very impressive with what LLPW did and how they really made sure that they set themselves apart with really showing those grappling skills and mat-based wrestling that obviously garnered them a lot of respect for the top tier wrestlers that they had in the company. So now we're going to move into more of a controversial promotion. But that is very 90s, by the way, when I was looking it up. And that is FMW, which was Frontier Martial Arts Wrestling. This promotion was a bit controversial, but it wasn't just an all-women's promotion. It actually was a hybrid promotion that featured a small women's division within it. And you had the infamous Atsushi Anita, who was the main star of FMW, but also the founder of the company. And the reason why I say he's infamous, because as I was doing research on Anita, it seemed like he would do anything to get some type of promotion or eyes on his product. It seemed like the more shocking, the better. Now, this was very popular in the 90s, so I'm not gonna pin that, you know, just on Anita, to act like he's the only promoter that really went for shock value at this time. But he certainly perfected it, to say the least. And this promotion was very similar to ECW, but you have to go up like and multiply that times 10, because they had death matches upon death matches. They would have barbed wire rope matches and exploding rings that we would always kind of see in the 90s when people would do the tape sharing, or sometimes they would show commercials late at night. Like literally FMW was that type of promotion. They thrived off the bloodthirsty fans of the 90s, which showcasing very graphic, brutal violence. And it really surprised me that at the time, because now I really wouldn't be surprised to see women be a part of a promotion like that, but I was surprised to see that in the 90s. They recruited women like Megumi Kudo, and Kudo started out as a heel, and it would really be remiss for me to not show this, but you just see someone like Megumi and you think she would probably be in All Japan's women's pro wrestling, which I think she actually did start out training in All Japan women's pro wrestling a dojo, but I think she decided, you know, obviously to take her talents elsewhere. And initially when you see her, you would think that she would be a part of FMW, but she in fact was. And she started out as a heel, but eventually became a babyface under the company. And she then became pretty much the face of the entire division. She was one of the first women to be in death matches, and she really gained a lot of respect and street cred for it. Kudo would be involved in a lot of death matches in the 90s. You would see her being beaten to a pulp by women like Combat Toyota and Shark, Shikuza, and coming back for more. And that was something that these fans from FMW really admired. And it, what I looked up, because I can be honest, before doing the research for this episode, I never really looked into companies like FMW. It's just not really my thing. No judgment, just usually not. I don't usually look up death matches. But out of curiosity, especially after initially seeing this picture of Megumi, I just had to see, like, why would she be in these matches? And then I look up and I see these were the type of experiences that she had being in this company, literally being lit on fire and obviously having these explosion matches that would many times leave her scarred and bloody because she would be falling into the barbed wire ropes. It was just like, what? But she had a very, very successful career there. But the downside, usually, I mean, we've seen this with other wrestlers from the 80s and 90s who were a part of these matches. The downside was already they had a small division, but a lot of women had to retire early, including Megumi, because they were very much injured most of the time. So I think there was only a few years of Megumi being part of the company. And within the 90s, she had to retire. So that resulted in FMW's women division pretty much disbanding in 1997. So I think that that at the time, when you look at it in retrospect, that there was like a purpose to this company having success, because later on you start to see, especially when real conversations towards the type of injuries and long-term effects that you have from having these matches really came into play. It allowed a lot of women to possibly still look at this or frame a reference to show how they can create really strong badass characters, but probably trying to tone in certain things to make sure that they had longevity to their career. So I definitely don't want to bash the efforts of the women from FMW, because actually one of my favorites from FMW happened to be and I was really excited to find this, because I didn't know much about FMW, was Combat Toyota. I love her personality and in-ring skill. I actually was able to watch this amazing match between Combat Toyota and Aja Kong. They really went at it and had a really solid match. So being able to see her work and her feistiness or her attitude in the ring, I love her in-ring presence, her gear, the way that she would come out with these really cool hairstyles. I just thought she had like the all-around package of a really great wrestler. And I love seeing her be a part of a lot of the inter-promotional events too, because she really had a lot to offer. So even if there are some things that you know may not be as crazy about when within the promotion of FMW, I would still recommend that you check out some of the inter-promotional matches where FMW were featured, and definitely check out someone like Combat Toyota, because she was just it for me. Like, she definitely represented the 90s wrestling that I absolutely love, and the personalities that came from that time. So as we wrap up the conversation with FMW, we move on to Gaia Japan, which was one of my favorites as we were coming into that next stage in the 90s, where you were seeing a lot of promotions kind of gear up to what was going to happen in the late 90s going into the 2000s. And in the time that Gaia came out, I think that they were already starting running pretty much and really trying to seize certain opportunities early on. To me, starting from that mid to late 90s, I feel that Gaia Japan was major competition for All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling. As they were moving into the millennium, Gaia Japan established working relationships with promotions like FMW and WCW in their first few years, and acquired top talent from All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling, especially because in the mid 90s, All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling, they weren't doing that great, and there were a lot of wrestlers that felt a bit disillusioned at that time, like their careers were not being seen as something that was a priority for the company. So a lot of them started moving to different promotions like Gaia Japan, as All Japan Pro Wrestling was also facing financial troubles. So we have someone like a legendary wrestler like Akira Hakoto come to Gaia Japan and kind of have like a not a resurgence, but just like another strong leg to her career in the 90s. You have Gaia Japan be formed by former crush gal Chikuza Nagayo, and she started this company and built it by establishing and helping to build a solid roster of brilliant young wrestlers like Miko Sanamura, and once again, really building off of the appeal of some very talented established wrestlers that really could guarantee that they can bring in a fan base. So those combinations, those two things really helped Gaia Japan early on. And they were able to go into the 2000s with a semblance of success, like for those first few years of 2000. And they were one of the few companies that started in the 90s that were able to not have to pack up their doors as soon as the 2000s came around. So that was pretty impressive. As I've looked into Gaia Japan for a few years now, because there'll just be matches that will pop up and things like that, I've always been impressed with the range of styles that Gaia Japan brought to the table. I think it really was one of the strongest companies, and one that I always think about when I think about Joshi history. So definitely one that, if you haven't seen it, check it out. They were really doing a lot, including their relationship with companies like CMLL, to really try to show different types of wrestling at that time, as well as another promotion that we'll talk about that also had a strong relationship with different Mexican promotions. So Gaia Japan certainly knew, and I guess maybe they were looking at a lot of promotions that were founded during this time, taking little nuggets of things that they knew would work and really applying that to their company. So hats off to them. And we go into another promotion that I think it had something there, but wasn't fully fleshed out, but still one that I would say was a strong competitor also once we got into the end of the 90s, and that was Arsen Wrestling. And that was started by Aja Kong. Once again, as we started to get into this late 90s with All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling kind of having a bit of trouble financially, but also the way that they were showcasing certain wrestlers that they probably felt were coming down to the end of their career. A lot of these female wrestlers just decided, you know what, I have ties to businessmen in the country. How about I actually utilize that and utilize my skills of seeing how, on some level, the business is ran and take what I know to be my skills to another company, while also adding some years to their career in the ring. And we saw that with Aja Kong. And Arson had his first show on February 18th, 1998, and it was called Virgin. And this promotion was also grapple-based. We see that a lot in the 90s where a lot of promotions really wanted to add in more of like a shoot style while also getting some mat-based worked in. And then at some points trying to connect martial arts into it. So definitely not a trend that wasn't really common at the time. Very common for a lot of companies to try to set themselves apart by having many styles on display. So the women wrestlers in Arson were showcased as these badass shoot fighters who were also easy on the eyes. These women would have the bikini photo shoots, all while having these hard-hitting matches and back-breaking trainings in their dojos. During their dojo sessions, they would learn a variety of styles, such as lucha libre, pro wrestling, and shoot wrestling. In the following years of the company, I think actually the next year of the company, they started up a pop group, which consisted of Fujita, Akino, and Iyako Humada, and they decided, Candy Okutsi, who started up this pop group called Kazai. And obviously, as soon as we hear that, especially we're looking at the history of Joshi wrestling, you can clearly see they were trying to follow that same pattern that was successful for All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling, was starting up a pop group with some of the babyface talent, usually some of the biggest babyface talent that the company has to offer. But it did not end up the way that they wanted with starting this pop group. And I really think you can, based on the fact that this was a really early promotion. I mean, literally the next year after they started the promotion, they decided to start this pop group while still really trying to find a solid fan base. So I don't know if that was the smartest thing, because even when you saw with Beauty Pair in the 70s, or the Crush Gals, many times, and I don't know if this was strategic or it was just a matter of coincidence, but it seemed like these companies will wait to see how that decade would do for them. And then in the middle of that decade, that's when they would try to bring on certain things like groups, because they would see how the fans would react to that particular faction first, or tag team, and also pair off with them having a large amount of a consistent fan base before they would do that. And at that time, technically in the late 90s, going into the 2000s, we had girl groups, but it was not as popular as it was in the 70s and 80s. Just wasn't. So I don't know if lightning could have struck a third time. And unfortunately, it did not. But even with that, you had a young Iyako Humada, who was the daughter of Grand Humada. And she was a newcomer that really had a spark, and she was seen as quite marketable early on for Arson. Aja Kong quit the company, though, in 2001 after a disagreement with management. And that just started a ripple effect of many things that just, you know, didn't go that well after that. They brought in Lioness Ahsoka to come in as a booker. And on paper, that sounds amazing because of the type of success that Lioness Ahsoka had in All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling. But a lot of the talent felt that Lioness was really putting herself as a main eventer and taken away from the young talent that really wanted to get an opportunity in this company. Humada was one of them. So she decided to leave Arson as well, and she joined Aja Kong in Gaia Japan. And shortly after that, only 2 years later, Arson folded in 2003. So even though Arsene didn't have this long standing flourishing into the business, and still was successful in offering an alternative and really showing off what wrestling in the 2000s, in my opinion, would look like with this hybrid of certain styles. A lot of women starting to have, across the board, like across the globe, starting to have these grapple and mat based matches. So I think in those cases, Arsene was successful for those reasons. But not all companies can last forever. And we certainly saw that with this company. So now on these two last promotions that I'm going to bring up, they also did not have a long time frame in which they were out there, but still successful in some ways, like to what they brought to the table. So we have JD Stars, which I really had to dig into like the vaults of information about Joshi Wrestling in the 90s to find out some things about this promotion. So we have JD Star, was founded by Jaguar Yokota, who, of course, was pretty much the ace of all Japan Women's Pro Wrestling in the early 80s. And she pretty much trained every woman that you loved that was a part of Joshi Wrestling in the 90s, and just has a resume that goes on and on in the wrestling business. So she decided to start a promotion, and she brought in talent like Aja Kong, Lioness Ahsoka as the top stars. And in 1998, unfortunately, she left the company, and the promotion was bought by someone else that wanted to completely redirect how the company was going. They wanted to have actresses that kind of turned into athletes. And obviously, it was a very common strategy that people used in the 90s and 2000s. But because of this, the company floundered by 2007. But from what I did see from the company when I watched certain matches and events, the wrestling, of course, before they switched how they wanted JD Stars to be, was actually really impressive because of the talent that was a part of it. So even though it didn't last long, I will say the quality to the events and matches were certainly top-notch and stuck with that 90s Joshi level of performance that we all know and love. So I'm going to go to the last promotion that I kind of highlight for the 90s, and that is the Neo Ladies Pro Wrestling promotion. And this was founded by Kyoko Inoue. And this promotion started off with 9 women who would wrestle multiple times and had freelancers that were also brought in. And one of the biggest feuds in this promotion was with Kyoko and Lioness Ahsoka. You had Yoshuka Tamura, who received a big push as well in this promotion, becoming their first champion. Izuku Mita, who had a big singles push as well. And we even had the infamous Nicole Bass wrestle here for a stint in 1998. But even with all of these things, the promotion closed its doors in 2000. But they did reestablish themselves as Neo Wrestling, Women's Wrestling, in 2010, and kind of had a bit of a resurgence there, which is always good to see that people can pick up the pieces and continue to go on. But as I saw some events from Neo Ladies Wrestling, once again, the same thing about JD Stars. They brought in the right wrestlers to really create some exciting wrestling, great matches, of course, solid matches. But when you have this influx of a lot of people starting companies, sometimes it can really affect one promotion getting a solid following from enough fans consistently. And many times you saw that with these promotions. So we talked about the different promotions, but let's talk about some of the most pivotal events that really helps to establish the conversation that's usually surrounding 90s women's wrestling, which were these amazing interpromotional matches that had these once-in-a-lifetime meetups with certain wrestlers that would come from completely different wrestling promotions that would come together and create these events that we still go back and can't believe that these things actually happened. So one of the first match and I get or events, and I think maybe this one was kind of like a tester to see if this would work, was Dream Rush 1992. And I must say, just like I pointed out when I was talking about JWP, I just think it's absolutely amazing how these companies were able to put certain things aside for the most part and come together to create these events and understand that these type of events were once in a lifetime, and they would get those crowds that they really wanted and get these matches that were just absolutely phenomenal. So big ups to all of these companies that decided, let's work together. And then, yes, when we're done with this, we can love our promotions for what they are and the many things that they bring to the table that are different from the other. And we can still have a healthy competitive relationship, but let's get this bag and create these awesome events. So we start off with Dream Rush 1992. I really think it was one of the first promotions during this decade that really showed what these interpromotional events for Joshi Wrestling could really do and how it could draw people from all over the world to want to see this. And this event took place on November 26, 1992, and was held in the Kawasaki Arena. This was one of the first interpromotional events that had women from All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling, JWP, FMW, and LLPW. And just some of the great matches that were on the card happened to be Kyoko Inoue versus Akira Hakoto. I absolutely love this match. I love the chemistry that these two have with one another. This is not the only match that they had in a decade, so if you want to see these women together, I would say do yourself a favor and go down the rabbit hole of seeing these two compete. You also have Bull Nakano and Aja Kong with their final match at this time after such a lengthy and just well done feud that went on, I believe, for a year at that time, with Aja Kong throughout this feud really just dying to get a victory over Bull Nakano. And in this match, she was able to receive that honor. And she beat Bull Nakano with Bull Nakano's finisher, which I thought was really cool. And when Aja Kong wins, you can see that she's very emotional. She's so excited to have this feat behind her now that she actually did this. And Bull Nakano was very happy for Aja Kong, just like in a genuine sign of respect as they embraced each other. And I thought that was really something memorable, especially when you usually don't see two badasses like Bull Nakano and Aja Kong really have those type of moments. So if you haven't seen that match before, you should definitely check it out. We also see Bison Kimura's retirement ceremony, as at that time, she thought that she would not have any more in-ring action. You have Aja Kong, who was her teammate many times in the past, a part of that ceremony and really embracing her and wishing her well. And one last match, highlight from this event would be Manami Toyota with her partner, Toshio Yamada, versus Dynamite Kanzi and her partner, Mayumi Ozaki. This was such a strong tag team match. And I was happy to see, even though I will have to continue to research that, that this pairing and the tag team that we saw with this was not the only match that they all had together, because this was such a strong match. And even saw with some commentary that people were giving that this wasn't even the strongest match that they had against one another. So I definitely want to check out. I believe they had a series of three matches in total during this year, I believe. And it just continued to get better and better. They all had amazing chemistry. And all in all, Dream Rush was a very successful show. Of course, you can't have a show that would be perfect all around, but I did think that they did a great job of really showing what the blending of these different promotions could do and what great matches you can see come out of it. So we're going to move on to the next event that just usually gets brought up when you're talking about 90s Joshi wrestling, and that is the All-Star Dream Slam event of 93. So in April of 93, All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling JWP, and LLPW come together for the Dream Slam event, which was 5 hours long. And it is considered to this day to be one of the best super shows in Joshi history. It features two matches that were ranked 5 stars by the Wrestling Observer, and the card had 11 matches in total. And I can definitely agree, this was a very strong show. And you can see, with even within a year's time, how the formula of having these interpromotional matches just continued to get better and better. And why, obviously, this wasn't the only Dream Slam after that, because it really just was a very strong show. And we go into one of my favorites personally, was the Wrestle Queendom of 95, which was to me one of my favorite years in 90s Joshi wrestling history. It was just a really good time. Everybody was on their A game. So this event took place 4 months after the Big Egg wrestling event. And at this time, we see Minami Toyota being elevated in All Japan Women's Wrestling and getting the chance to really show what she can do as a main event star. We have Bull Nakano, who is still, at this time, the WWE Women's Champion, and she defends it that night against Kyoko Inoue. And I think, personally, this title defense was one of my favorite title defenses of the WWE Championship, even to this day, in my opinion. It was a very strong match and really did show, within the short frame of time that Bull Nakano had the title, what type of defending champion she would be. Very strong match. And we also have, throughout this particular event, women representing CMLL in this pay-per-view, such as Lady Apache and Lady Felina. And I really think that as we see these interpromotional matches, I love that it wasn't just promotions in Japan, that they were completely open to having some of the best from around the globe. And I love how CMLL would really bring some strong competitors of their own during this time to Japan, and vice versa, when women from Japan would also go to compete in CMLL. And we have, for the main event for this event, Minami Toyota versus Aja Kong. I mean, do you really need a critique on what that match would be? They were in the right to put these two amazing women as the main event. And honestly, is one of the strongest reasons, outside of the other matches mentioned, on why people really uphold this particular Wrestling Queendom pay-per-view up so high. So then we go into, I feel, the event that people usually bring up when someone says, you know, I want to get into 90s Joshi wrestling, where should I start? They usually bring up the Big Egg Wrestling Universe event. And this was an event that was big time, but I don't ever think that this could be done again, because it was just on such a high scale that I don't think that it could ever be duplicated or replicated again. This event was held in the Tokyo Dome on November 20th, 1994, with an attendance record of 32,500 fans. And one of the most talked about events in Joshi history, and this event lasted 10 hours, which does sound crazy to me before, you know, you really look into it. And then I thought, if this sounds crazy, then we must be crazy, because we will sit down, including this week, and watch a super long pre-show of WrestleMania followed by 2 stacked nights of WrestleMania. So actually, this was one of the precursors to having a very stacked long event that certainly has some amazing wrestling in it. So it is worth that time to check out this pay-per-view. And as stated, it was promoted as one of the biggest cards in the history of women's wrestling, and they certainly did not lie about that. This show featured 23 matches. The opening ceremony featured a 60-piece band and a parade of wrestlers that each carried a flag representing a different wrestling promotion. So just big deal all around and huge presentation. You had the best of the best come together for this event and put on dream matches, because at this time, we really started to get a feel of what type of Joshi wrestling was going to be, promotions were going to be around. So, of course, you start thinking about what if this wrestler from All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling for someone from JWP. You started putting these together, and the Big Egg Wrestling Universe definitely helped to soothe the needs of wrestling fans that wanted to see some of their favorites from different promotions compete. And this event generated approximately 4 million in revenue from ticket sales, as well as 1.6 million in merchandise. So even though they put on this huge show, had the runtime that they did, and certainly paid a lot to create this extravaganza that we've seen, that gamble certainly paid off. You had women from Gaia Japan, JWP, LLPW, FMW, MPW, and WWE. So it makes sense why this was 12 hours. So obviously, there are so many other events that we can cover, including how some events became annual. But I wanted to make sure that I pointed out some of the events by some of the most popular events that people would usually go to and pinpoint a certain year where they felt like it was at its best. And speaking of these promotions coming together from around the world, we see All Japan Women's Pro Wrestlers kind of going back to that groove that they had in the 80s, where they started competing, or at least having some spots in time where they would go and wrestle for WWE. And we saw this in 1993 when WWE reinstated its women's championship, which had been vacant since 1990. Alundra Blaze won the six women's tournament by pitting Hailey Lee Morgan to win the WWE women's title. And behind the scenes, Alundra really wanted to develop a phenomenal women's division. And she knew that Joshi wrestlers and some of her former opponents in All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling could help her do that. So soon you start to see Bull Nakano being brought into the company and being a bona fide rival for Alundra Blaze. And that gamble certainly paid off, but I don't think it's that much of a gamble considering, just like I mentioned in the last deep dive, that the working relationship that WWE had with All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling really did pay off. The fans actually did react positively to the talent that was brought in. So it really doesn't surprise me that the same happened in the 90s. So you really have the super over baby face and the Alundra Blaze completely get annihilated whenever she was in the ring with Bull Nakano. And I like how Nakano was kind of a shock to the system for a lot of American wrestling fans who possibly at that time only followed WWE and usually only saw female wrestlers that were like Alundra Blaze. And Nakano was a true heel. I think in many ways she even rivaled a lot of the male heels because she would really go into that. She wasn't necessarily trying to be PG. And she donned the multicolored spiked hair. She wore heavy metal or comic book inspired shirts. And she fought a very rugged, unchained animal pretty much in the ring. And it really resonated to make her unliked by the fans and really have them clamoring for Alundra Blaze to win. So just all in all, a really good call on from Alundra Blaze to really push to have this talent that she had really good chemistry with prior to her coming to WWE to come in and help to really develop some type of a roster for the women. And Nakano and Blaze's feud was successful and weaved in to the two having an excellent match at the Big Egg Wrestling event in Japan. I love that representation that you saw with WWE and how they made sure that they also covered that event and made sure that the American fan base knew that Blaze was trying to develop herself as a world champion, just like how you saw with Bret Hart when he was doing that. I love that they tried to make sure that they were showing that with Blaze's efforts. And Nakano was able to win the WWE Women's title and defend it in Japan. Shortly after she lost her title, Nakano was released for allegedly being in possession of drugs. So what the WWE did, they just decided to bring in another monster heel to really take it to Medusa. And that was going to be Aja Kong. So we see as we get into 1995 that they want to bring in some more Joshi talent. And we see that at the 1995 Women's Survivor Series match, where you just get a wealth of Joshi talent that were really on the rise at that time. So we don't only see Kong come into the Survivor Series match, but we see Tomoko Watanabe, Lioness Ahsoka, Kyoko Inui, Saki Hasegawa, and Chaparita Asari in this 4-on-4 Survivor Series match. And Chaparita was actually able to compete on Raw against Aja Kong in a really solid match that actually really had the crowd rooting for Asari. I thought that was pretty cool that she got that type of reception, but it was obviously also because of how well that Aja Kong was playing to the heel role. Now, I do think that in some cases, especially when they had the heels from Japan, sometimes that commentary, whether it was in WWE or WCW, they were just going too hard on it, just being too ruthless with really trying to set it home that they just felt like these were like unattractive women coming in to beat up their beautiful baby faces, American baby faces. So sometimes they're trying that. But on this match, I actually did enjoy how they were showcasing Aja Kong from the Royal Rumble, from the Survivor Series to this Raw singles match that Aja Kong had. You could really tell that they wanted to give Aja Kong the rub to really show that she was next in line to hold that WWE Women's title. However, WWE felt that they needed to trim some fat in the company. And of course, they have to start that out with eliminating the women's division. So as soon as we geared up for all of this great roster building that was supposed to be in the works, and you could clearly see that that was going to happen, the rug was just pulled from underneath all of this female talent, and including the leader of this women's roster, Alundra Blaze, and all of that hard work was just kaput, which was very sad to see, because I believe if they really would have continued to build up this roster, because mind you, this was 95, so if they would have continued to build this up by the Attitude Era, we really would have had a very solid women's division. And don't get me wrong, after the Attitude Era, WWE definitely did build up a strong women's roster, but if they really would have built on this talent that they have, and most of these women still compete to this day, so that means they definitely would have been able to be a part of that roster, who knows what would have happened. But we leave WWE as they left us hanging with the women's roster, and we go to WCW, who in the following year of 1996, they decided that they wanted to revive the very abandoned women's division that they had in 1991. And this was also due to Alundra Blaze going back to WCW to become Medusa again. So Eric Bischoff wanted to play off that and start Medusa into, you know, starting with her and then bring in other women for Medusa to compete with the thought that that can turn into possibly a solid roster. So we see Medusa and Sherry Martel kind of have a feud. It was kind of like an exciting teaser, but we didn't really see it gain legs due to Martel leaving the company shortly after. So Eric Bischoff decided that it pretty much was a desert in America when it came to female talent. So he would also have to look at talent from Japan. And Japan in the 90s was a great helpmate to WCW, whether it was on the women's side or the men's. When it came to successful collaborations, to talent exchange, they really did help WCW as well as Lucha Libre. So we see the newly formed Gaia Japan promotion, who won it and needed exposure on a global scale, decided to allow some of their talent to compete in the 8 women's tournament to determine who would be crowned the first WCW women's champion. So we start to see women like Akira Hakoto, Bull Nakano, Chikuza Nagaya with a new character called Zero, who I really like that character, come in to compete in this tournament. And this is when I really, really started to pick up on things happening in wrestling because I was so young. But I really don't like how sometimes people try to sleep on WCW with some of the things that they came up with. Because obviously, yes, we can always bring up the things that weren't that great, you know? Okay, I have to point out, I absolutely love this picture of Aja Kong with Goldust backstage after the 1995 Survivor Series, because it's such a cute picture where it just seems like Aja Kong was so thrilled to meet Goldust and her just having a moment where she, you know, was just being sweet and relaxed. I just thought it was so cute when I saw this. But you can go back to my point. When you saw women like Bull Nakano, if you had never seen them, maybe you didn't watch WWE at the time or have access to Joshi Wrestling, and then you're seeing Akira Hakoto come out and Zero with this amazing paint and just badass look, how could you not be geared to see what a potential women's division could do at that time? Gosh, I was so in love with this teaser that we got for off and on for about a year of what the women's division could look like in WCW at the time. And this, with the establishment of the WCW Women's Cruiserweight Division, which they were trying to get off the ground, we saw a young Miko Sanamura compete in WCW. And those matches were usually on their Saturday night show, but they were very impressive matches that kind of showed what the younger talent could do outside of the tournament for the WCW heavyweight women's title, which really saw a lot of legendary wrestlers who had a lot of time in wrestling. So I liked how they were showing that difference, where you saw a woman like Miko Satomura that was really going to make what wrestling was going to look like in the 2000s. So with both the women's cruiserweight division and the women's championship tournament, they really could have had something there if WCW felt like they really wanted to pull the trigger on making a strong foundation with it. At the end of the tournament, we do see Akira Hakoto win the championship after she beat Medusa. And one of my favorite matches, women's matches that they had in WCW, honestly. And I was very excited to see Akira as the champion. I just remember just being in awe of Akira. So I just love that she received this opportunity. And I loved Medusa, but I was so excited to see someone that really brought something unique to the table actually win the title. But not too long after Akira won the title, once again, you see something that has great potential completely dissolve, and we don't see anything really come out of the tournament. They pretty much dissolve the women's, the potential of a women's roster. And I think Akira, she defended the title in Japan, but it wasn't televised. If I remember, I don't even think that WCW even said anything about what happened during the turn, during the title defense. We just don't really see the title again. I think maybe Medusa kind of got the title, but there wasn't a match for it. And then after that, we don't see or hear about it again. So it was like an experiment that could have gone well and had all the tools that you would have liked, but just was thrown away. And before I leave this, I have to say that one of the major players that I absolutely loved on screen that to me usually does not get a shout out was Sonny Ono. He was managing everybody. He was getting coins left and right, making sure that he was always managing someone. And he just had great comedic timing. He knew how to really have a presence at ringside without upstaging the wrestlers that he was managing. So shout out to Sonny Ono being a part of this time in WCW and really making the Joshi wrestlers look good with how he was showing them off. I just love Sonny Ono. So you see, this partnership with WCW and Gaia Wrestling was short-lived, but it helped Gaia Japan establish themselves as a promotion that featured a range of highly experienced wrestlers with a pedigree in the industry, as well as a promotion that welcomed fresh young talent that would make a mark in the business in the 2000s. So to be honest, those moments of the women's tournament and trying to establish for a very short time a women's cruiserweight division did lend WCW some great TV time or footage, but they did not really want to push for it. And really, Gaia Japan was the one that really got the good rub from having their talent in WCW. So honestly, Joshi Wrestling really won from this experience, to be honest. And you know what? Is that really bad? I don't know, because honestly, the reasons why these promotions, these little stints of trying to develop women's wrestling in companies like WWE and WCW were successful were because of the Joshi women's wrestlers. Obviously, Medusa played a huge role in that as well and did a great job of really wanting to showcase Joshi wrestling and have some great dance partners. But sadly, it just wasn't in the cards for these the women like Medusa that just really wanted some solid competition and couldn't really get that. So now we're going to kind of go and do like a quick dive into some of the top stars from this time period in the 90s. And we start off with someone that we have mentioned several times because she was just all throughout the 90s a huge deal. And we start with Aja Kong. And Aja started off in the 90s in a tag team called Jungle Jack with her tag team partner, Bison Kimura, and they entered a two-year feud against their former allies, Bull Nakano, and Jungle Jack was able to win the WWWA World Tag Team titles twice. And Kong pursued Nakano for that WWWA Singles Championship throughout this time as well. And it took several attempts before she finally achieved this on November 15th, 1992, ending Nakano's three-year title reign, which was a huge deal at the time. During 1995, Aja was placed as a monster heel to a white meat babyface, Alondra Blaze, and she was set as the next in line to take the place of Bull Nakano as the big, mean foreigner that wanted to absolutely destroy the beloved American wrestler. Aja Kong was still in line to face Alondra Blaze at the 1996 Royal Rumble, but sadly, as we described just a few moments ago, WWE scrapped the women's division. So Aja Kong just decided to go on with a very successful career. And in 1997, she left All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling to start her own wrestling company, Hypervisual Fighting Arson, or simply Arson. She left the organization in 2001, but still had a successful career going into the 2000s. And even now, as she still main events certain promotions. And you see that longevity is certainly because Aja Kong just has it in her bones to constantly be the best. And we certainly still love watching her. I think for this Mania weekend, she's going to be wrestling for the Spark promotion, which is an American Joshi-based promotion. So even to this day, Aja Kong is still handling business. So now we move on to one of my favorites from the 90s and beyond in my mind, which is Mainami Toyota. Mainami made her professional wrestling debut in 1987 at the age of 16. Her big break came in her second year at the first WrestleMarine Payette show in 1989. She had such a strong showing that night. She really stole the show from the veterans, which was a great sign moving forward into the 90s as to what she was going to do for the company. Toyota won her first title in November 1989 when she defeated Mika Takahashi and for the All Japan Championship, but she vacated the title to challenge Bison Kimura for the All Pacific Championship and emerged victorious. Manami's feud with Toshiro Yamada paralleled her to the success to kick off the decade, but she also became a fantastic tag team and won the UWA World Tag Team title in January of 1992. And the WWA tag team belts in March of the same year. Toyota's single career flourished when she defeated Kyoko Inoue for the IWA single championship, and she defended it 8 times in the span of 3 years. At this point, Manami Toyota's in-ring skills were compared to that of the male counterparts of that time, and she was seen as one of the best in the world. Her match at Queendom 3 saw her become the 39th WWWA World Singles Champion. However, her 60-minute match with her arch-rival Kyoko Inoue is still seen as one of the best matches of the year of 1995. So Manami ended off the decade well with having incredible matches with Aja Kong, Yakuza Nagayo, and Akira Hakoto. I will always say that Manami, and I love that this is usually the case when you hear about her, she is, I think, will always be seen as one of those rare talents that just has it all, from the technical skills, amazing submission-based wrestler, high-flying skills, even with her personality, she just has the aura that she is a leader, a quiet, humble leader that really loves the art form of wrestling and always tries to put her best forward when presenting wrestling. And I just cannot get enough of Manami. I really think that she deserves more praise for what she did for Joshi Wrestling in the 90s. Certainly will always be one of my favorites. We move on to Bull Nakano. We cannot forget about Bull Nakano, especially this week when she's going into the Hall of Fame for WWE. So by the time we get into the 90s for Bull Nakano, she is positioned as the ace. And in January of 1990, Bull wins a tournament to acquire the vacant WWA Singles Championship, which she has held for 3 years. After this run, AJW's use of Nakano in storylines and matches kind of decreased, which was really weird because Bull was really still in her stride. But I think that was All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling's shady way of making it clear that she was getting older and she was probably going to have to leave the company soon. So Nakano went to Mexico to compete in CMLL in June of 1992. And during a 12-woman battle royal in that year, Nakano defeated Lola Gonzalez to become CMLL's first World Women's Champion. After she lost the title in 93, she took up the opportunity to see what it would be like to wrestle in WWE. And she debuted as an associate to Luna Vachon and had a legendary feud with Alundra Blaze. Both women were able to take this feud to the Big Egg Wrestling Universe event, and this saw a cross promotion that really made this feud even more intense, as these women would travel around the world to get their hands on each other. Nakano won the title from Blaze at the Big Egg Wrestling event and went on to defend her title against Kyoko Inoue in March 1995 at the Queendom Victory pay-per-view. And her reign lasted for 5 months with the WWE title. Bull Nakano had 2 more matches with Blaze before being released from the company. And we kind of see Bertha Faye and Bull kind of switch roles, you know, with being in a feud with Alundra Blaze. And in 1995, Nakano was a part of the infamous New Japan WCW collision event that took place in Korea. and Nakano and Akira Hokoto teamed up during that event to take on Manami Toyota and Mishi Yoshida. Later that year, WCW brought in Nakano with Sunny Ono as her manager, continue her feud with Medusa, going well into the year of 1996 with some legendary matches that they had even outside of that WCW Women's Tournament that I would recommend that you check out. And we see in 1997 that Nakano would retire from wrestling due to injuries. But as we've seen over, I would say, probably the last 5 to 10 years, Nakano, after just taking some time to live life, even having a golfing career, came back to really help this next generation of women's wrestling. She is very much a part of the Sekuban wrestling promotion that just started in 2023. And I really think it's a company that can do well. They're based in America, but they are a Joshi-based wrestling company. And you just see that Bull Nakano still has her hands in the wrestling business, as she should, considering everything that she has done for wrestling. So we move into another woman that had a huge role to play just in 90s women's wrestling in general, but certainly had a great stint in All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling, and that is Medusa. Medusa really set out in the late 80s to go to Japan and see what type of success she could have in All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling, and it was a great call on her part because it really set the tone for the respect that she would get in wrestling as one of the women that was really trying to push for wrestling to be taken seriously in America. So I think it was important for her to have that type of experience in Japan first before she came back to America. And Medusa wrestled a 6-week tour for All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling at the beginning of 1989, where she won the IWA women's title from Chikuza Nagayo before dropping it back the next day. She then began her journey of training in Japan, learning the Japanese wrestling style as well as Muay Thai, kickboxing, and boxing. This discipline caused her to sign a 3-year deal with All Japan, which was the first non-Japanese wrestler to do that. She had some feuds, and I think one of the infamous outside of Bull Nakano was this infamous series of matches that she had with Aja Kong, where they kind of put on shoot fights, and one consisted of boxing, the other kickboxing, and then an all-around just shoot fight that neither woman knew that they were getting into, but they just went with it, you know. This led to Medusa really being looked at as a badass for going into these matches and actually looking good in them. So she left All Japan Women's Wrestling in 1991 to work in WCW, but she got back into the ring very quickly, not too long after that, with the Joshi wrestlers that she was used to working with and had a lot of respect for later in the decade. And I think that she just played a big role into really having American fans who possibly weren't diehard fans that would look at Joshi wrestling, having a front row seat to it because of what they did in WCW and WWE. So a huge hats off for Medusa for really fighting for that the great rosters that she was trying to really put out there with creating wrestling that really started with and really had a solid foundation. It could have in WWE and WCW with solid Joshi wrestling foundation. So shout out to Medusa for really making sure she was campaigning for that and wanting the best talent, not being a hater, but she actually wanted some of the best talent around the world to be a part of these rosters so that everyone looked good. I really love that. And now we got to come to my girl, Akira Hokoto. I absolutely love Akira Hokoto. Every time I even go down the rabbit hole of just like watching so many of her matches, I fall in love again with her. I just think she's a once in a lifetime wrestler. I don't think you can make another Akira. At the age of 18, Akira made her debut with All Japan with her wrestling. She won the Rookie of the Year in 1985. The next year, she won the All Japan Women's Junior Championship. She won the WWWA Tag Team Championship with Yumiko Hara in 87 during a 2 out of 3 falls match. Akira took a tombstone pile driver and legit broke her neck. She continued on with the match, and during the match can be seen holding her head in place with her hands. This definitely gained Akoto the reputation of being extremely tough. In 1990, she was booked to win the Grand Prix tournament, but sustained a severe knee injury during the match with Manami Toyota that tore open her knee and rendered her unable to walk. She decided to tie a bandage around her leg and try to pull herself back into the ring, but after she attempted this, the match had to be stopped and she was removed. But that once again added to this reputation that Akira had of being tough as nails. When she came back from that injury, she had a completely different persona aesthetically. She grew her hair longer and dyed it blonde. She wore flashy attire, used stylized makeup, and called herself Akira Hakuto after a popular wrestler, Akira Mita. So she won at that time. Right after that transformation of her character, she won the WWWA tag titles twice with Tsukuya Manami and the All-Pacific Championship in 1991 and 92. One of her most celebrated feuds is that with Shinobu Kendori from the LLW promotion. During this captivating interpromotional period for Joshi Wrestling, their match at All-Star Dream Slam in 1999 is considered one of the best women's matches in history. And I was able to watch that during the research for this match, and everyone is right in that assessment. This is one of the best matches, not just of this era, but I think in women's wrestling history. You have to check that out. So she won the Grand Prix in 1993. And when she married fellow wrestler Antonio Gonzalez Mendia, she moved to Mexico and competed in CMLL and adopted the persona Rina Kabuki. In 1994, she defeated La Diabolica for the CMLL World Women's Championship and held it for 2 years. When she divorced, she headed back to Japan in 95, and that's when she appeared in WCW with manager Sunny Ono, and she helped to draw a lot of attention to the Gaia Wrestling promotion. And after her stint in WCW, she took a break and returned to Gaia in 2001 before officially retiring in 2002. Akira has had such a phenomenal career in wrestling. If you have never seen any of her work, I really implore you to do that today, okay? Because there's so much there. She is truly one of the best wrestlers. I think that even with the many injuries that she received, she always came back stronger. So I can never speak more highly of Akira. She's just, like I said, one in a million, truly. So we move on to one of my favorites that I started to discover as I maybe like 2 to 3 years ago really started to look into Kyoko Inoue. And she made her wrestling debut on October 11th, 1988. From 1991 to 1992, she worked for CMLL in Mexico. On May 11th, 1994, she made her first appearance on WWE during a live event in Japan, where she unsuccessfully challenged Alundra Blaze for the WWF Women's Championship. Throughout her time in All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling, she would hold the WWA World Singles Championship 3 times, the All-Pacific Championship 2 times, and the WWA Tag Team Championship 4 times, as well as the IWA World Championship. In the 90s, Kyoko was known for her high energy, charismatic persona that really connected with the big crowds. And I think also like the younger girls that would watch wrestling. And it really showcased to me, like she helped to showcase that fast paced wrestling that we saw a lot in the 90s, but she actually showed that off well. So I will always like that energy that Kyoko brought to the table, because I really feel like she fit into bringing in and continuing to have that younger teenage demographic being fed. So I really love seeing her work from the 90s. And she still wrestles today, by the way. So next we have Cutie Suzuki. I really thought it was important to get her out because I think that she was a strong talent that came from the JWP promotion. And she was successful enough to be featured in the all-women's wrestling game that was based on her, entitled Cutie Suzuki No Ringside Angel. And in 1995, WCW's World War III pay-per-view, Suzuki and her team, a partner Mayumi Ozaki, defeated Bull Nakano and Akira Hakoto in a tag match that was well-received from the fans. And she retired at the close of the decade. And yes, she didn't have the long storied career as you see someone like Bull Nakano or Aja Kong. But I think with that feat of literally having a video game made based on you and being able to have a successful career in JWP and have a strong showing, even though honestly she really could have had more because she was in a solid tag team, I think these were still huge accomplishments for women's wrestling in the 90s, where honestly sometimes there weren't that many opportunities. She certainly capitalized on that. And the last woman that I will highlight, but to me is probably one of the strongest examples of why 90s Joshi wrestling was really amazing, is Shinobu Kendori. I did not really know Shinobu Kendori before I started doing this this research. And she was a former judo medalist. Her in-ring character consists of her really feeling that pro wrestlers were beneath her, and she would use her mixed martial arts background to really take it to her competitors. And Kendori actually started out by getting her training in the New Japan Pro Wrestling Dojo, and she debuted in JWP in 1986. And I love her quick rise within the promotion. And she also had stints where she fought men at the time and still had MMA fights throughout her career in wrestling. Some real life drama with her and Jackie Sato led to shoot fights in the ring for JWP. And that actually caused Jackie Sato to have to retire because she was genuinely injured so severely that she had to retire. But even without the controversy, and Kendori eventually leaving JWP to go to LLPW in 1993, I still feel that when those issues weren't there and she had strong competitors, she had some matches that truly add to the tapestry of 90s Joshi wrestling. In 1998, some of Kendori's best matches were against Akira Hakoto and Manami Toyota during the mid-90s. Definitely check that out. And in 1998, Kendori became the WWWA World Singles Champion after she defeated Yukumi Hota and held it for Yumika Hata, and held it for a year. And 2002, Shinobu became the president of LLPW. So really moving up the ranks, making some successful moves for herself. And I just loved looking at Shinobu's catalog because to me, she was like the embodiment of that hybrid wrestler that usually had a background in combat sports, MMA, and judo. So they usually gave off the impression to the audience that they can legitimately mess up anyone that they faced. And to me, that was very reminiscent of what you saw with like Ken Shamrock in the 90s and then a little bit later on Brock Lesnar. I feel like Shinobu was definitely giving off those vibes in her matches. And I absolutely loved looking at her catalog. And when she found the right dance partner in these matches, they truly made you want to have it last longer and longer because it was just great, great matches. So definitely someone that I was very impressed with when I was doing the research and certainly deserves to get that spotlight. So I would say in the conclusion of this episode of Deep Dive, after looking at so much content from 90s wrestling, this is pretty much like my thoughts on it. during this decade, we saw a lot of women's wrestling promotions pop up and make an impact into the tapestry of what 90s Joshi wrestling was and why it's so memorable to us. It was also ironic to me that these promotions worked so hard to create a new lane and to create diversity in the women's wrestling world in Japan. However, some of the most successful women's wrestling events that happened at that time were interpromotional events that saw millions of dollars of revenue when these groups will all come together to bring something. So even though you saw these splinter companies and people having infighting and not feeling that they can work together, the biggest success actually came from them uniting. With the advent of video games becoming even bigger in the 90s, we see Joshi Wrestling being able to capitalize on that with games like Cutie Suzuki, No Ringside Angel, or Sen Nippon that was for PS1, which I discovered today, actually. So I'm going to take a look at that. I thought that was pretty awesome that they were able to be a part of that video game frenzy that we saw in the late 80s and 90s, like completely take over everything. And it also always added a sense of legitimacy to a company when they were able to get these type of deals. So I love that Joshi Wrestling in the 90s, where they were freaking killing it, was a part of that frenzy as well. So we see the opportunities, even a lot of female wrestlers that decided to retire, getting opportunities to work, still work in entertainment, and be a part of some local films, really being able to have opportunities outside of wrestling because of what they did within wrestling. The overall look of the decade immediately made you think that you were in a video game, be it with the gear of the wrestlers that went up a notch, like 20 watts up. And even to this day, that's one of the biggest things that we bring up is the wrestling gear and the elaborate, amazingly elaborate entrances that you would see from wrestlers at that time. The custom graphics for the tell of the tape that we would see before these matches were amazing. The photo shoots that they would have, to me, even to this day, is still top notch. The 90s really showed off for Joshi Wrestling this futuristic new millennium look, especially when she started to get to the end of the 90s, that I absolutely loved and certainly can't be replicated. We really should take a moment to thank Jaguar Yokota for training a lot of the women that we saw come out of All Japan Women's Pro Wrestling that would make the 90s Joshi Wrestling what it was. Women like Manami Toyota, Aja Kong, we really owe that insight and also that sense of reverence that Jaguar Yokota had with not only starting her own promotion, but really seeing that it was important in the 80s to take care of the women that would come after and really see that they take it a step further from what they had before them. And that certainly paid off. We would not have had this amazing decade that we can look back on without the effort of trainers like Jaguar Yokota, and also her taking a risk with starting a company that honestly was a solid part of 90s Joshi Wrestling. Oh, thank you. Shout out to Women's Wrestling Talk Pod. So great seeing all the wonderful content. Cheers. Thank you so much for watching this. I was so excited to bring this type of series to the show because I felt like there's so many nuggets of things that we see now that we really like, but we don't know sometimes that a lot of things are, you know, based off of inspiration from earlier time periods in women's wrestling, or just, you know, an awesome nod to a lot of female wrestlers that loved the history of Joshi Wrestling. So I'm so happy that we're able to go down these different decades that really helped to lay the foundation of what we saw in the 2000s with Shimmer and Impact Wrestling, or that golden age in WWE. And then what we're seeing now over the past 5 years with the Women's Revolution, and how you're seeing even women like Mercedes Moné making it very clear that when she really wanted to tap into what type of wrestling style she wanted to go to the Mecca of Japan and really look into adding some things to her arsenal from Joshi Wrestling on top of the Lucha Libre inspiration that she has as well. So it has been awesome to go over this lengthy, extremely filled history of wrestling. Even with this 90s Joshi Wrestling episode, there was still so much that I couldn't include because it was a decade that really spoiled us with how much content was actually a part of this decade. But you know what, guys? I tried my best. I hope that you enjoyed this. And if this inspired you to go down the rabbit hole of looking at 90s Joshi Wrestling, then I certainly applaud you and I wish you well with trying to make sure that you can maneuver through all of the things that you can find within that decade, because it is a lot. But I hope you enjoyed this episode. I really look forward to the next episode of Deep Dive and figuring out where we're going to go to next. But thank you so much for watching. I hope you enjoyed and I hope to see you soon.
Women's Wrestling Talk, the number one women's wrestling show on the planet.